UEG Talks, gastroenterology to go. Welcome to our GI podcast. Listen for fresh insights and perspectives in science, education, and professional development.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this episode of the UEG Talks. My name is Pradeep Mundre, and I'm your host for today. So this is the part two of the two-part podcast on metabolic medicine, endoscopy, and surgery. In part one, we covered anti-obesity drugs with Professor Carol LaRue. In that episode, we discussed about the pathophysiology of obesity, the aims of treatment for obesity. If the listeners have not listened to that episode, I would strongly recommend listening to that episode before this one, because it carries on nicely to this episode. Professor LaRue, in that episode, beautifully outlined the aspects of obesity and discussed the medical and drug management of obesity. And in that episode, he mentions how body fat, body weight, or fat mass is physiologically controlled phenotype, and obesity is due to an inappropriate regulation of the fat mass and not because of overeating. We also discussed significant progress actually made in the field of anti-obesity drugs and combination therapy, and how the new drugs are achieving weight loss nearly approaching that of metabolic endoscopy and may even challenge surgery for that matter. And we need to debate that, of course, in this episode. But I did ask Professor LaRue the question about the new drugs, and I asked him, would there be any role for endoscopic interventions or surgery if with all the new drugs and combination therapy? And his answer was a very positive yes. He mentioned that all options remain and should be available to the patients for the patients to decide depending on the resource availability and patient choices. So in this episode, we take those things forward with the intervention side of things, i.e. we discuss about metabolic endoscopy and anti-obesity surgery and how these interventions fit into the treatment paradigm of our patients and how best to make such decisions with patients at the center of the decision-making process. Today, we are very lucky to have two eminent guests within their field. Firstly, I'd like to welcome Dr. Ivo Boskowski, who is an assistant professor at Catholic University in Rome, Italy. Ivo's an expert in bariatric and HPB endoscopy, with a particular interest in development and testing of new devices and new technologies. Welcome to the show, Ivo.
Thank you. Thank you, Pradeep. Good morning.
So joining Ivo today is Professor Ralph Pitelli, who's a senior consultant in surgery and head of metabolic bariatric surgery at St. Clara Hospital and University Hospital Basel in Switzerland. Ralph is also past president of the Swiss Society for Study of Obesity and is an ambassador to the European Association for Study of Obesity. And Ralph's been an investigator in several international multicenter randomized trials on metabolic surgery. Welcome, Ralph.
Thank you, Brad. Welcome.
So, Ralph, maybe I'll start with you. I was discussing with Professor LaRue about the historic aspects of obesity, and he mentioned that obesity has always been prevalent in the past. And I can see from your background, paintings of Botero, which indicates that obesity has always been there. But he mentioned that in the 1980s, it sort of significantly increased in prevalence. We discussed some horror stories about the treatment of obesity in the past. Do you think you can highlight the origins of surgical management of obesity and any fascinating or interesting facts about surgery in the past?
First, I must give maybe a definition. If you talk about bariatric surgery, these are procedures at the gastrointestinal tract to treat obesity and as a consequence, improve or even lead to a remission of associated complications. And then you have metabolic surgery, not primarily aiming at reducing weight, but more like directly targeting these metabolic diseases such as diabetes, MASH, or hyperlipidemias. And actually, it started with metabolic surgery in the 50s of the last century with jejunal ileal bypass, a very aggressive procedure, shortening the small intestine, but being very successful in decreasing mortality due to myocardial infarctions and stuff like that, but obviously in the long run leading to liver failure. So it has to be stopped doing. I mean, we're not allowed to do that anymore. But then came a lot of other procedures that really aimed at weight loss first. And maybe that is a story we get back into when we talk about different procedures.
And how has this evolved over time then? Have things changed or has the standard surgical procedures remained the same?
Well, I mean, in the 60s, the first gastric bypasses were performed. And actually, this is still the procedure that stays and has the best results in the long term and the best documented results. So everything that's new has to be compared to that procedure. So all other procedures that have put staples or bands or sutures in or around the stomach, they have all gone. So that's probably where we get into later on. And then there are others that have actually what needs to be for sustainability is some sort of hypoabsorption, meaning that you have to have a certain bypass of certain length of small bowel. And that is probably what the evolution will go to.
Right. Okay, fine. So we'll come to that in a moment, Ralph. Before that, before discussing the sort of procedures and the efficacy, I just want to discuss about the aims of treatment of obesity. And Professor LaRue in the previous episode mentioned weight loss as a surrogate for treatment of obesity. And he mentioned a meaningful weight loss to get better health outcomes for our patients is about 10%. What he mentioned is that the overeating does not cause obesity, and he alluded to that it's the obesity which causes overeating. So undereating or restricting food does not fix obesity. Fixing obesity treats to undereating. So it's a new concept even for me. I always thought differently, and most medical practitioners thought about obesity very differently in the past. From the surgical point of view, what would be your aim of treatment? So what are you trying to achieve in terms of health outcomes?
Well, weight loss still is a very strong driver for better other outcomes, such as improvement or remission of comorbidities, I mean, diabetes, cardiovascular health, or preventing cancer. But then also this leads to a lengthening of expectancy of life up to 12 years, depending on age and gender. And also it has to lead to an improvement of quality of life. And at the end, it's also should be cost effective and cost saving. And these are the goals that for the surgical part, we could prove that it works.
Okay. So it's not just an aesthetic surgery, but you're improving the health and mortality for our patients. Is that what you're alluding to?
Yeah, correct. I forgot the mortality. You're right. I mean, it's the expectancy of life that is being improved. But the patient, I mean, if you said, Carl said at 10% initial weight loss, you have an improvement. But the more you have, the more improvements you will have. I mean, if you have 30, 40% from the initial weight, and depending on the height of the patients, this is also being taken into account. But the patient, if he has 200 kilos and he loses 20 kilos, he will not really have a big profit. So, I mean, these relative numbers have to be put into perspective of the patient itself.
Right, okay. And then moving on to the sort of surgical options that are existent for our patients or that you practice in your practice. Well, can you just briefly outline the surgical options that currently exist or currently performed and which are the most popular ones and how effective are they? How much weight loss are you achieving with those?
So as I said before, the gastric bypass is still very popular, but depending on what region in the world, in Switzerland, it's 75-80% of the procedures are bypasses or variations of bypasses. But in the United States and some countries of Europe, sleeve gastrectomy is much more popular, but that comes from surgeons who are used to do gastric bands and may not be familiar with the technique of a gastric bypass, which I think is a very bad reason for not performing the proper operation. And then the sleeve gastrectomy has become very popular in the last 20 years as an isolated operation. It is part of the biliopancreatic diversion duodenal switch, where underneath the sleeve you have a duodeno-ileal anastomosis, so bypassing the largest part of the small bowel. This is a very aggressive operation, but the sleeve itself is successful, but in our RCTs, it turns out to be less successful and sustainable like the bypass. And especially, we have a conversion rate within the first 14 years of 34%. So a purely sleeve gastrectomy, only two-thirds will stay with that operation with a fair result, which will be less than the bypass. And then there are variations of the bypass. One anastomosis gastric bypass, falsely called mini bypass, and other variations. But all the purely restrictive procedures, I mean, they are hardly not done anymore at all.
So is gastric banding completely out of fashion? You don't undertake anymore?
No, I've done my last one 18 years ago. And in the United States, they continued a little bit longer, but then they found out that that's not working also. So there are very few people that still continue to do it. But I mean, there were times when they were horizontal or vertical staples, or the vertical gastroplasty, ring augmented gastroplasty, and all these kind of operations, then they're gone.
Okay. So to summarize, Ralph, so currently it's gastric bypass and sleeve gastrectomy. But the issue with sleeve gastrectomy, you mentioned 30 to 40% conversion rate. Is that because they don't lose weight? They don't get the results? Or is that because of some other reason?
70% is weight loss issues with or without reflux. 30% is reflux, GERD.
Are they equally efficacious in terms of, you know, the amount of weight loss, which is a better surgery when it comes to outcomes?
No. They are the gastric bypass. You can we usually use, there are different measures. I mean, we use excess BMI loss, so it's at 5 years, it's 68% for the bypass and 61% for the sleeve, and at 10 years in our RCT, it's still 65% for the bypass and only 55% for the sleeve in the protocol analysis.
Right. Okay, Ivo. Just want to come to you next in terms of the endoscopic options. Can you briefly outline when it started, when did sort of one of gastroenterologists or even surgeons started endoscopic procedures historically, and how has this changed over the years?
Well, endoscopic bariatric endoscopy started in the late 80s with the placement of space-occupying devices, and these are balloons, gastric balloons. So the first balloons were placed in the late 80s in Europe. Then in the 90s, it exploded. In the past 20 years, we gained a huge experience with balloons. There are thousands of publications on it from endoscopic point of view and also compared to surgery. And we, again, we saw the same results, the same publications after 20 years from different authors and so on. So the same experience that have been seen before is re-seen again. So, however, this was the start of bariatric endoscopy and space-occupying devices in the stomach, which is restrictive procedures. In the meantime, a new device came, which is a full-thickness suturing device in 2012, which is a device over the scope. So I personally touched it with my hands in 2012. And in 2013, we already started doing procedures, revisions, endoscopic revisions of gastric bypass, and this was the overstitch device. And so the first idea was to treat patients that had previously done surgery as an enlarged gastric outlet after gastric bypass, patients that regained weight and those that had dumping syndrome. Then just a few years after, we endoscopists made the endoscopic sleeve gastroplasty, which is some kind of a replica of the surgical sleeve, even though these are two completely different procedures, because by the oral route endoscopic, there is organ sparing. So we simply shrink the stomach from inside. And then this was the turning point, the moment when we learned that we can give simply better restrictive procedures. So in 2015, here in Rome, we literally stopped placing gastric balloons. Today, we place balloons only in very selected patients. And mainly as bariatric endoscopic procedures, we do endoscopic sleeve gastroplasty with different suturing devices, because in the meantime, other devices have come from other companies. It's a very big field. We do also metabolic procedures, rejuvenation of duodenum for diabetic patients. And lately, just this is the last trial, we're doing rejuvenation of the gastric fundus with amazing results in combination with endoscopic sleeve gastroplasty.
So, Ivo, to conclude, you're saying the days of, because I struggle to understand the concept of endoscopic balloons. Sorry to go back to that, because that is not a solution as a permanent solution. You know, you take out the balloon, can't stay forever. You remove the balloon and patients go back to their physiological set point in terms of body fat. So considering it's not a permanent solution, which you've said that you rarely do this. So is that completely out of fashion now because of that?
These are balloons are excellent devices that have their indication. However, the adverse events and symptoms after the placement are incomparable compared to endoscopic sleeve gastroplasty. When we do endoscopic sleeve gastroplasty, the patient goes home with one pill with Buscopan or simply one or two painkillers, while with the balloon, the patient has 1 week to 10 days pain, vomiting, nausea. It's really, really totally different compared to endoscopic sleeve gastroplasty. And then you need to remove the balloon in case of those that are placed endoscopically, or balloons placed endoscopically. And the procedure is short when you do endoscopic sleeve gastroplasty.
Maybe this is a question to, or a discussion for both Ralph and Ivo. How does an endoscopic sleeve compare to a surgical sleeve in terms of efficacy, in terms of, you know, forget about the surgical side, forget about the cost and things. Now, how does this compare in terms of efficacy? Because that's the main thing that we focus on.
So, of course, surgical sleeve is more effective compared to endoscopic sleeve from one hand. And it's a surgical procedure. You have a removal of big part of the stomach, almost 70%. And it is linked to some serious adverse events like fistula, like dehiscence of the suturing line. We see often these patients because simply we are a referral center here in Rome for the treatment. Even though globally it has a small incidence as serious adverse events, Ralph can confirm. And in expert hands, it's a rare complication on one hand. From the other hand, the endoscopic sleeve gastroplasty is a repeatable procedure, partially or totally reversible, can be done also in patients with reflux disease. There is some evidence that the gastroesophageal reflux disease can have benefit of it, while the surgical sleeve cannot be done. It's an absolute contraindication in patients with reflux, unless the surgeon is making a huge repair of the diaphragm and all the structures that are around the esophagogastric junction, and if that is possible. And the endoscopic sleeve gastroplasty can be done in deep sedation, can be done in outpatient, has very few contraindications like atrophic gastritis, autoimmune gastritis, known history of tumors, of gastric tumors. And we do it also in patients with esophageal varices, in patients candidates to liver transplantation, a kidney transplantation. Even if there is portal hypertension, we have different protocols on this. And then the most important thing is that bariatric surgery has age limits. Mainly it is done, at least in Italy, their patients simply are not operated surgically if they're above 67, 65, 67. We have patients that have undergone endoscopic sleeve gastroplasty at 86. So if they're in good shape without major comorbidities that can preclude general anesthesia, patients can simply be done. So it's like pretzel. It fits for the pediatric population. There is evidence from 7 years of age above. It fits for the geriatric population, for the third age. Has almost no comorbidity limits and so on, but it's not as effective as surgery. And the most important thing is that it is repeatable. And now in outcomes of total body weight loss, we are established at 16% to 17% confirmed at 5 years of follow-up.
Ralph, I think I really want your opinion on this as a surgeon about endoscopic versus surgical procedures, considering that you said you predominantly you prefer bypass versus sleeve.
Well, maybe first I have to really say I work for the last 30 years in a team with gastroenterologists and surgeons. We are the same family. So I do not have anything against endoscopists. In the contrary, I deeply depend on them in many cases. So I do not believe that this has a future. But if endoscopy procedures like with magnets or other devices can produce a certain bypass imitation, then I'm open for that. So I think this, what you do now with the endoscopic sleeve gastroplasty is the same thing we did with the gastric bands at the time when we were not able to do laparoscopic procedures in very obese patients, but we learned with the easy operation all the principles of laparoscopic obesity surgery. So I think you as endoscopist, you also learn, as long as you work in a multidisciplinary team, a lot on how you can go on with endoscopic procedures. But actually, I do not agree with this. It's the same operation like the sleeve, because you do the same operation like the laparoscopic gastric plication. And this has been abandoned because it's just not working. And the weight loss, I mean, why? I know why you don't reduce the volume of the fundus. But I mean, we know from the sleeve, if we leave any fundus, it's not working. So why should it all of a sudden, by doing the sutures from the inside, have a different pathophysiological effect or another mechanism or the same mechanism compared to a surgically produced sleeve or gastroplication? In other words, you leave the fundus, obviously for reasons not to hurt the spleen. I'm very happy you don't touch the spleen, but it doesn't make sense why all of a sudden this should not be an issue. And then you mentioned 16 to maybe 18% total weight loss. I mean, Wegovy, that's what Wegovy does. Mounjaro does more, and a bypass does a lot more. So I think in terms of durability, of course you can do it again. But I mean, I could do bands. Sometimes I did 3 times a band in one patient because I was convinced it's a good operation. Today, I would not do that anymore.
So first of all, there is robust literature stating that bariatric endoscopy works with leaving the fundus open and all the mechanisms have already been described more than 5 years ago. So I won't go deep into this. Second, in 2022, we were losing patients because of GLP-1s. Ralph mentioned one. Today, 98% of our patients, we do up to 9 procedures of this on week, every week. Also, we work in a very big multidisciplinary team. And most of the patients are coming from the bariatric surgeons from all across the country. So 98% of our patients have already been on GLP-1 drugs that have been suspended either by intolerance, either by cost. The patients have issues in doing this constantly, and we do endoscopic sleeve gastroplasty. So what is emerging now today is that you have one procedure that has been in more than 5 publications in very prestigious journals, been stated to be extremely cost-effective compared to injectable drugs and compared to surgery for class 1 and 2 obesity, and especially works with very low dosages of GLP-1s. Then you have up to 26, 27 of total body weight loss at 1 year when these drugs are interrupted and then placed again. So we already have this huge experience with bariatric endoscopy, which is one and done right now. And I can say also more lately, we are combining this procedure because we are doing a lot of research here at the Catholic University at Gemelli Hospital. We have seen that in the fundus, the ghrelin cells are hypertrophic in obese patients. So what we do endoscopically, we rejuvenate the fundus of the patient with hybrid APC, and we do endoscopic sleeve gastroplasty. At 1 year, our total body weight loss mean is 27% by a single procedure that lasts 25 minutes and can be done also in deep sedation. Of course, we will see what will happen in the future. But what Ralph said also is very important. The surgical and vertical sleeve gastroplasty didn't work 25 years ago or 20 years ago when patients were collected on the street and operated directly without any kind of multidisciplinary board. Today, every single patient is selected for one or other procedure. And since we are treating a chronic degenerative relapsing disease, if these patients are not followed up, which was the case 20 years ago, and I hope it's not the case today, these kind of procedures work because you see the patient in 3 months, 6 months, and 1 year, 3 years, and so on. And the patient has total support. When something doesn't work, we simply consult the patient. We either give drugs or we repeat the endoscopic sleeve gastroplasty. In some cases, we send these patients back to the surgeons, but this is very rare.
Probably I'll come to you sort of on a practical note. Let's say I'm a patient with obesity. I come to your unit. Can you just talk us through how various treatments fit in your unit? Do you follow a certain path, start with drugs? How's treatment decisions made? Where does different treatment modalities fit in the patient's journey?
Well, the patient applies to be evaluated by our multidisciplinary team, and they're always first seen by the physician, nutritionist, and psychiatrist. And then as a team, we decide if they are candidates for surgery. If they come to our center to, then they want to have surgery. That's what we are known for. Then after that first selection process, they're being referred to the surgeon. And then they go back to the outpatient clinic that's run by the physicians. I don't follow up the patients, but they are very nicely followed up. But this is, when Ivo mentioned that, I fully agree there's follow-up is necessary, but that depends on the healthcare system. I mean, in Switzerland, this is paid. The Swiss, a bit neurotic, they obey orders. But I mean, if you look at the Gulf region, where there's a surgeon surgeon and endoscopist in Saudi Arabia who performs like 1,000 ESGs a year, claiming he has, in his publication of the 3-year results, he has a follow-up rate of 83%. And honestly, the really neurotic Swiss, they show up at 5 years in 90% in our institution and at 10 years, 75%. But I really doubt that you can achieve 83% in a region where the people don't show up anymore, where they have to pay for the follow-up visit. So I really challenge a little bit this durability issue about the procedure. I mean, you can do it again, and we talk now about the ESG, but how do you think this is going to be in the long run? And why don't we have, for a procedure that's out for 12 years, why don't we have 5 or 10-year results published? Ivo, tell me.
Yeah, of course. I personally started doing these procedures in 2014/15. We have follow-up on almost 80% of the patient. We're continuously publishing our experience inside prospective and retrospective trials, if there is something interesting. And we are coming with a publication on this. Our follow-up is almost at 7 years/8 years in some cases. And the patients that are followed up are those that appear. Of course, we are treating obesity in these patients, not always appear even for the first follow-up visit.
It looks like debates will remain. And this is something we all as multi-professionals to discuss in the future. And we will have to see how the future changes with the new drugs, how all these procedures fit in. But what is clear from both of you is probably gastric bypass remains a very effective, durable treatment that works, probably is a gold standard, what I can sense. Maybe, Ralph, can you comment on gastric bypass and the durability of the treatment?
Well, there is no treatment that has 100% success rate, but actually it is for about 90% of the patients, it's durable and very long run. I mean, the Jobi subject study, there were not only bypasses, but I mean, we have 30-year results. There are a series, very nice prospective trials that have long-term results with a very durable weight loss. But that, of course, the variability of the individual weight loss is great. So that's why we do a lot of research on limb length. So we try to improve by bypassing more small bowel without increasing efficacy without increasing too many deficiencies or especially malnutrition. This is still ongoing. It's a large multicenter trial we just closed a year ago. Now we're analyzing our early data. So there's a lot to improve also in these existing procedures. But again, to give Ivo a justification, I don't offer it. Again, I'm burned as a young surgeon with gastric bands. I don't want to go into that again. But we have to push the innovation forward. And maybe actually there is room. I mean, I can operate almost any patient. I have no age limit. I don't have any other limit. But there are patients that will not be suitable for surgery. There are patients who do not want to have surgery. But I don't like if gastroenterologists try to promote it because you don't need an intubation or something like that. Because I don't think that is really an issue in any of these patients. But there will be a place, but for the time being, it has to be better, a bit more durable, and I need some long-term results to offer it to a certain selection of my patients.
I just should add something for clearance. We endoscopists are doing copy-paste, so when we see that something works, we want it. So we are doing endoscopic bypass. It's some kind of single anastomosis bypass. There are patented devices. There is a company that developed this. So there is a wire that has green light, red light, that is pushed through the pylorus, 1.5 meters down in the intestine. Then we go back, we perforate the stomach, we find the light in the intestine. Then we make endoscopic anastomosis. We do this every day with endoscopic ultrasound. We connect the intestine to the stomach, and then we clog the pylorus and do endoscopic sleeve gastroplasty. This is repeatable and reversible. I have personally done two of these on pigs. It is still on animals, but this is something that is coming for endoscopists. Of course, if I ever start these kind of procedures, I would love my bariatric surgeon standing next to me in case there are some issues, because there is also a learning curve. But this is coming.
Yeah, maybe you will have to find a clue how you will close the mesenteric defect, but you'll find a clue.
Yeah.
Okay, so Ralph, what percentage of your patients do you offer bypass versus sleeve? Is your predominant surgery bypass?
Yeah, it's about 85 to 90%, depending on the year. I started with 65% in the past and the past 18 years. But now it's predominantly some sort of a bypass procedure.
Okay, so point of discussion for both of you. In your own practice, how do you see things would change on a practical note in terms of weight loss management?
Well, I think, as Ivo mentioned, maybe actually the combination of drugs that can be taken in orally, they will come. I mean, there are at least one, but it's not very efficient, but there will be new ones. I mean, there are about 40 compounds in the pipeline. So we will have new drugs, maybe that will become cheaper also. And in combination with some induction weight loss with endoscopy, that can be a solution for some patients. So I think there is a lot of innovation. But I just really would like to emphasize that if you start doing these procedures and these combinations, that it is done within a trial so that the patient knows he's undergoing an experiment. That's what we fight in Switzerland. Every procedure that is offered to a patient with obesity has to have a standard procedure. And if you have something new or if you change standard procedures, then it must be in a trial with ethical approval. And we have had surgical cowboys in the past that did terrible things. And I just hope that the endoscopist will not do the same mistakes than we did.
Yeah, I agree with you on that, Ralph. Ivo, how do you think things change in your practice in terms of future of the weight loss management?
I totally agree with Ralph. You know, endoscopy by nature is repeatable, and so this gives to it some of the privileges. So if we want to understand the future, we should see the past. So how surgery evolved in the past 100, 150 years. So today we're switching into mini-invasive and totally mini-invasive. So probably also endoscopy is too invasive for certain diseases. And more science and research go forward, more we understand that we are treating mosquitoes with nuclear bomb. So how I see it for the next 10 to 15 years, or I can say also 5 years, you have seen this very fast evolution of drugs. However, we are still not there due to many, many issues connected to the drug industry that has invested a lot of money and now wants the money back, even though I'm convinced there are effective drugs that are somewhere hidden and they're simply waiting to have the money back from the drugs that are now available. It's, of course, a business plan that I do not agree with, because we need to treat patients, not to make profit out of it. However, if you see bariatric endoscopy, in the past 5 years, there have been more than 15 new devices, and I have been the first one in the world of testing a new robotic device that makes the endoscopic sleeve in 60 seconds by suture automatically. We are becoming less and less invasive. It is the same in oncology. You have immunotherapy today. Most of the cancers are treated with immunotherapy, with new drugs. Surgery comes less and less and less. So it is a normal evolution. And thanks God it is like this. So it is very, very fancy time to be in this field and seeing all this progress of new devices, new drugs, and of becoming less and less invasive.
Thanks for those final thoughts, Ivo. Ralph, any final thoughts or take-home messages?
Well, it's also an endoscopic industry playing a big role and pushing forward these methods. And many endoscopists, they just enjoy to play around. I mean, we all enjoy playing. I just hope that all of you, believing in the progress, which I do myself, stay humble and respect the lives of the individuals. And in that light, I'm really looking forward to everything that comes up in the nearest future.
Is the patient respect, and it's on the basis of we are a research hospital, and every day we have proposals from some companies to do a first in human, and more than 80 to 90% are refused because we do not believe those devices. So if there is not a good research behind, and if there is any issue, so the respect for the patient comes first.
Yeah. So with that, I think we're going to draw to the end of this conversation. Ivo, Ralph, thanks for taking your time. I know it's been really difficult to arrange this appointment with three busy consultants. Thanks so much for your time, and thanks for your commitment.
Thank you.
Thank you.